This is Law and Disorder.
Today on Law and Disorder, we get insights from an ex-CIA analyst, a real insider, Ray McGovern, on the Mueller investigation and on the allegations against WikiLeaks and Julian Assange. We'll also speak with two of the people who worked on an explosive revelation about how Jewish charities in both New York, Chicago, and San Francisco helped fund the vile anti-Muslim, anti-Arab campaign called Islamophobia, which has been going on with increasing speed since the attacks on September 11, 2001.
Stay with us.
I'm New York City attorney and author Michael Stephen Smith.
And I'm New York City attorney and activist Heidi Boghossian.
The prevailing Russiagate narrative is that Russia colluded with Donald Trump to swing the 2016 election his way. Special Prosecutor Robert Mueller has led a nearly two-year investigation in search of proving this. Under American law, when a crime is committed, prosecutors search for the culprit. In this case, critics say, the search is for the crime. The investigation seems to be winding down with the expectation that he will soon issue his report. The major news media, Hillary Clinton, the Democratic Party, and the intelligence community have conducted a drumbeat with a nearly fact-free assertion that the Russians helped steal the 2016 election. Is this story true? Is there more to it? Donald Trump, after all, ran his campaign on a position of easing tensions with Russia. Is it really in our interest to perpetuate a Cold War with a nuclear-armed power? Did Russia use WikiLeaks and its editor Julian Assange to reveal secrets about the Democratic Party? What were these secrets? What danger to free journalism and to truth-tellers and whistleblowers does the acceptance of the allegation of Russian interference in the U.S. elections are we facing? Returning guest ex-CIA intelligence analyst Ray McGovern shares his insights. Ray briefed President George H.W. Bush every morning on intelligence matters, particularly with respect to Russia. He is a founder of VIPS, Veteran Intelligence Professionals for Sanity, and a contributor to the blog Common Dreams. Ray McGovern, welcome back to Law and Disorder.
Thanks, Michael. Good to be back with you.
Ray, we lost the great journalist Robert Perry almost a year ago, and he was on top of the Russiagate story like no other journalist. What did we learn from Bob?
Well, the last piece that Bob wrote was the 13th of December, so about a year ago. And it had to do with the disclosures the day before about the exchange of text messages between the deputy head of counterintelligence in the FBI, Peter Strzok is his name, and his paramour, Lisa Page, who happened to be the principal lawyer for the deputy director, McCabe. And they were exchanging these messages indicating that the FBI and the Department of Justice, get that, Department of Justice, were doing everything they could before the election of 2016 to make sure that Trump didn't win and that Hillary did. Here's Peter Strzok. We can prevent Trump from winning. Lisa Page. Peter, you've been investigating Russiagate, so to speak, for 7 months now. Now Mueller is taking over. Are you going to go to Mueller? Strzok. Lisa, I don't know. There's no big there. Whoa! Mueller takes him on anyway. Then, by accident, the Department of Justice Inspector General uncovers these tapes, and Peter Strzok has to be struck from the from the roster of 20 people that Mueller has working for him. So, long story short, that was the key. That not only was it an obvious case of trying to excuse Hillary for losing, not only was it an obvious case of trying to prevent Trump from improving relations with Russia, it was more than that. It was actually, Russiagate had sort of evolved into FBIgate or Deep Stategate. Now, Bob Perry was his own man, of course. He's the best journalist around, and he very seldom compared notes with me. But he did that day. That day was 12th December last year. And he said, "Ray, do you read this the way I do?" And I said, "Yeah, it's really amazing, isn't it?" And he says, "Yeah." And then I thought maybe I ought to say, "Well, Bob, you've already written three articles on this just this month, that is earlier in December. Would you like me to take a whack at it and get something out tonight?" And he knew that he wanted to do a fourth, and so he did. And it lays it all out. Now, after that, on Christmas Eve, so what, 11 days later, he had his first stroke. Then he wrote his apologia on New Year's Eve at great difficulty because his vision was so blurred he could hardly see anything. And he died after two more strokes and then a diagnosis, a very late diagnosis of pancreatic cancer. Later in January. So Bob was the guy. Bob looked at Russiagate and found it to be very, very interesting in terms of what the Department of Justice, I'll say that again, and the FBI and the CIA felt they could do before the election of 2016. Now, before your listeners kind of scratch their heads and say, is McGovern saying that the top... Did McGovern say that the top law enforcement and intelligence officials in our government were lying, were taking great liberties with the Constitution and the law? And McGovern says, "Sorry, folks, that's exactly what I'm saying." Well, how could he do that? The answer is very clear. Comey said it himself in congressional testimony under sworn oath. And what he said was, quote, "We were all expecting that the next president of the United States would surely be Hillary Rodham Clinton, and we were acting in that environment," period, end quote. And so, I mean, it's not really hard to understand. If she was a shoo-in, as everyone thought she was, and this disruptive person, this unpredictable person, this person who actually criticized the FBI and the CIA, who was to have any chance, well, they want to make sure they blocked that. And so they did the dossier, they did all these other tricks because they knew that Hillary was going to win and that rather than being indicted, they would be honored with their present jobs or maybe even move up to a higher job. So it's not hard to explain. That's the way it went down. And now, I'll just finish with this. Last week, the trove of documents released by Mueller and other attorneys was a deep disappointment to people who have been making a lot of money on Russiagate. Why? Well, because it makes it quite clear that Mueller has nothing. All these people that he's indicted on unrelated to Russiagate charges are being let off real, real easy. And people like Michael Isikoff, who wrote a book on Russian roulette, he's one of the foremost proponents of Russiagate. Even he, when was it? I guess it was Saturday. He gave an interview where he's backing off as gracefully as he can, saying, and I quote, "What Mueller has is not what we had hoped for," end quote. Wow.
Ray, I want to ask you if you would break it down for us with the various groups involved. Let me list them. The CIA, the FBI, the Justice Department, mainstream media, the military-industrial complex. What role did each one of these entities, if you will, play in perpetrating this? There's no there there.
Oh, I'm sort of glad you asked that because I have a new acronym for your listeners. It's called Mickey Matt, okay? Mickey Matt. Now, we used to talk about the MIC, the MIC, the military-industrial complex. And we also know that Eisenhower wanted to say military-industrial congressional complex, but they said, "Oh, that's going too far, Ike, okay?"
They took that out of the draft of the speech.
They did, yeah, but of course it belongs in there. So here it is. It's the Military-Industrial Congressional Intelligence Media. That's the big new media. Let's see, Academia Think Tank Complex. So, Mickey Matt, okay? They're all together, Michael. It's clear as a bell. Look at the coverage that the Times and the Post gave to the Flynn testimony. Look at the TV pundits. I don't, but I read about them. And my God, they're all, Rachel Maddow is still running off mad, actually, about Russiagate. So what I have to tell people is this. Look, the truth is out there now. The question is whether the media will tell the people the truth, and that's an uphill battle. The deep state, which is all these people you just mentioned, DOJ, FBI, CIA, and the mainstream media, okay, they always win. Always. So to see people like Devin Nunes, the head of the House Intelligence Committee, on camera say, look, if we find out that they committed offenses, yes, you better believe they're going to be brought to trial. Whoa, well, Nunes is not going to be the chair in January. So they're still fighting uphill. Those who, like us, are trying to pursue the facts and find out what's really going on. And the deep state usually wins. So we'll see. One little thing I would add here is that this decision on Syria. Oh, Trump tweets. that's a new one for me. Usually executive orders were not done by tweet. They tweet, so we're going to pull out our troops from Syria. Well, I'll believe that when I see it. And why do I say that? Because Trump is not in charge. He's afraid of the deep state. And that's why he's been so, you know, so cowardly, so reluctant to challenge him. All he has to do is say, look, by tomorrow, I want the entire text of the application for the FISA warrant. Now, FISA is the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act. You need a warrant to monitor American citizens like that fellow Page, okay? And that application is right there. What does it indicate? It indicates that this so-called dossier that was prepared with money from Clinton and also from the FBI, if you can believe it, that was used to justify, in quotes, the FISA warrant, and that is a clear violation of law. That's what Nunes has been pleading with Trump to release. Trump promised to release it a month ago, and 3 days later says, oh, no, I talked to the Department of Justice, and they say they can investigate this, and I don't need that. Well, he's afraid of him, and that's part of the story here. The deep state rules, we'll have to see if when Isikoff and the others all kind of back off and then try to desert the ship, if they're honest enough to do that, then we'll see that the Russiagate, you know, again, a broken clock can be correct 2 times a day, okay? And so it is with Trump, who I think is the worst president the United States has ever had. He's right about 2 things, or maybe 3. He's right about Korea. He's right about Russia. And he's right about this Russiagate thing. But he doesn't have the strength of his conviction. He doesn't have strong advisors. He doesn't have the guts to face down the deep state and say, look, I'm president here. I order that transcript or that particular FISA application be declassified and released. There's no secrets in those applications, and he won't do that because he's afraid. Now let's see if you back down on Syria, too. Remember where you heard it first. I don't think that's going to go through.
Let me shift our discussion a bit, if we might, to WikiLeaks and Julian Assange, because WikiLeaks and Julian Assange have also been blamed for Hillary Clinton's defeat, and it's been alleged that WikiLeaks and Julian Assange got into the Democratic National Committee's computer, and they stole information out of there that hurt Hillary Clinton. Can you talk to us about what the real facts are there and what kind of danger Julian Assange and WikiLeaks and really free journalism is now facing because of that?
Well, let's see. Where do you start? The allegation that the Russians hacked into the DNC, let's do the Democratic National Committee computers first. Okay, the allegation that they hacked into the DNC, which has no evidence behind it, and which our NSA people, our alumni, tell me that they would, NSA would certainly have that if it were a Russian hack. That is spurious. Now, the President of the United States, most people don't realize this, but Barack Obama, 2 days before he left office, he referred to that intelligence document of January 6th, and he said, and I quote, "The conclusions of the intelligence community with respect to how WikiLeaks got Russian hacking are inconclusive," period, end quote. So the conclusions are inconclusive. Do they matter? Well, hello, if you can't show how so-called Russian hacking got to WikiLeaks, you don't really have much of a case. Now, I had occasion to ask the Director of National Intelligence at the time, James Clapper, just 1 month ago. I said, now, how do you explain? Are you briefed them on the 5th? You say they were conclusive. Here's, you know, we don't, can't prove it, but how do you explain how Obama didn't believe you? And he looked at me, and he, this before crowd at Carnegie. He says, well, I don't know. I cannot explain why. Well, I can explain. He's a lawyer. And he, you know, just wanted to go out with a somewhat clean slate on this, just to say, well, you know, be able to say later, I did warn the American people that those conclusions were inconclusive. So what do we have here? We have WikiLeaks being blamed for this. Is WikiLeaks guilty, so to speak, of publishing documents that may have hurt Hillary Clinton? The answer to that is yes. Were these documents authentic? The answer to that also is yes. Did these documents show that Hillary stole the nomination from Bernie Sanders? Yes, the answer to that is yes, too. Okay, now, WikiLeaks got that through a copy, through a leak. Somebody put a thumb drive into the DNC computer. We think we know who that was. His name is Seth Rich, but you won't find that in any mainstream media. To mention Seth Rich immediately brings you the accusation of being a, quote, conspiracy theorist, end quote. And this is a tactic that goes back to the Warren Commission, really run by Alan Dulles, former head of the CIA, when people objected and said, hey, wait a second, we think the CIA might have been involved in this. He says, aha, conspiracy theory, and it's worked ever since.
Sometimes conspiracy theories are correct. That's my conclusion from that. What dangers does Julian Assange face now? Lindsey Graham, if I remember correctly, said that he and WikiLeaks were a non-state foreign intelligence operation against the United States. He's been holed up now for over 6 years in the Ecuadorian embassy. The United States is trying to get their hands on him and bring him back here. And I would imagine charge him for a conspiracy to violate the Espionage Act, which carries the death penalty. What do you think the future holds there? What can we do about it? Because if they can get away with bringing Julian Assange back here and putting him on trial, I think every journalist who receives information is in a lot of trouble.
Well, that's indeed the case. Let me see. WikiLeaks. Julian Assange has this incredible capability to get leaks, and I emphasize again leaks, because hacks can be gotten by the NSA, who collects everything. He gets leaks, and what's the most important leak he's gotten? It's called Vault 7, okay? And Julian announced this in March of 2017, and he said there's more interesting information and more damning information in this leak than in all the documents that Ed Snowden brought out into Hong Kong. Wow. So, we don't have much time. Let me talk about one of the leaks, which talked about a cyber tool developed by the CIA together with NSA, and it's called Marble Framework. What does that allow the CIA to do? It allows it to hack into computer systems, servers, or computers themselves, like the ones at the DNC, disguise who hacked in and leave telltale signs in five languages, actually, Chinese, Korean, Arabic, Farsi, and Russian, Cyrillic, and leave telltale signs, breadcrumbs. Now, those who know about the accusation that the Russians hacked into the DNC know that these breadcrumbs were left behind. Suffice it to say that although we cannot prove forensically or from the principle of physics, as we can prove that it was a leak, not a hack, although Bill Binney, the NSA former technical director, and I can't prove this, you know, it's not a leap of imagination to say, who hacked into the DNC and left these telltale signs? Could it have been Marble Framework from Vault 7, the disclosure that somebody in the CIA gave to WikiLeaks? Indeed, it could, we think. Now, you mentioned that it was Mike Pompeo, then CIA director, who called WikiLeaks a non-state hostile intelligence agency. That was 13 days after WikiLeaks divulged this cyber tool called Marble Framework. They're out to get him. Now, I have some good news. Some friends of mine who are very close touch with Julian tell me that that today, perhaps as we speak, there are members of the Bundestag in Germany who are visiting Julian Assange. They're going to have a press conference later, and the actual message here says that they're representing 36 European Parliament members, MPs, who are united in solidarity with Julian. They're being received at the Ecuadorian embassy, and they will hold a press conference at the Frontline Club. So that's the first diplomatic support. That's the first support by a legislature that Julian has been able to garner. The rest of us have been supporting him simply by telling the facts rather than the strained accusations. Do they hate Julian Assange? Of course they hate him. Why is the most recent? Well, there are two recent ones. One was his saving Ed Snowden from being captured in Hong Kong. People don't realize or remember that. And then this business about Vault 7, very damning authentic documents. Once again, that's what Julian trades in, indicating that the NSA has helped CIA develop these cyber tools, and that John Brennan, former CIA director, created a whole directorate, a whole directorate for this operation. Now, in my day, there were three directorates in the CIA, so this is several thousand people. And as I say, Bill Binney and I suspect, though we can't prove, that all this business about telltale signs in Cyrillic, the Russian intelligence service is not so sloppy. It's pretty obvious to us that this is John Brennan's operation, and that's why they hate Julian Assange, and that's why we have to stand behind him. Now, the other aspect you mentioned, danger to journalism, it's very clear. I mean, the First Amendment guarantees freedom of press. So if they attack him as a publisher, well, New York Times, Washington Post, everybody is in danger. But that's where they're going after him, to try to find some conjured up evidence that he's a spy, that he actually solicited these leaks, and that they bring him back here to the U.S. and give him the treatment that Bradley, now Chelsea Manning, encountered. So that's why they're after him. This is today's news is a good sign that some people in Europe at least care about freedom of the press. You won't find much in the New York Times. Every now and then they say, this might endanger our freedom. But, there's so much involved with MICIMAT, the military, industrial, intelligence, congressional, media, academia, think tank complex, that you won't hear much of a bleat from the New York Times.
Ray McGovern, it's great to be able to interview you. Most enlightening. Thank you so much for being on Law & Disorder. Before we let you go, though, can you tell people how they can follow your work at the Veterans Intelligence Professionals for Sanity?
Yes, we publish first and foremost on consortiumnews.com, which is the website that Bob Perry set up more than 20 years ago. But I have my own website. It's not hard to remember, raymcgovern.com, and everything I write or my interviews and sometimes my speeches are posted on there by my son, my webmaster.
I hope people tune in to both consortiumnews.com and raymcgovern.com. Ray, it's been a real pleasure to have you on Law & Disorder. You take it easy and good luck with your move.
Thanks. Bye now.
Visit us online at lawanddisorder.org for archived programs and links to many of the issues we discuss.
Fear and hatred of Arabs and Muslims existed in the United States, especially after the first Gulf War started by President George H.W. Bush, a decade before the attacks on September 11, 2001. This fear and hatred increased tremendously in the aftermath of these terrorist attacks. How could it be otherwise? It was used to stir up the American public in the ensuing devastating war against Iraq, whose government was falsely accused of having weapons of mass destruction and linked to the attacks of 9/11. And then wars were also fought simultaneously in six other predominantly Muslim countries. Anti-Muslim fear and hatred has been promoted in the United States by several groups and people, including Pamela Geller, Daniel Pipes, and David Horowitz. It turned out that these people and the groups through which they operate were massively funded to the tune of millions of dollars by the United Jewish Appeal in New York City and other Jewish charities in Chicago and San Francisco. We learn more about this operation from our guests Donna Neville and Asaf Calderon. Donna Neville is a community psychologist, educator, and co-director of PARCO, a participatory research center. She's a longtime organizer for justice and is a founding member of Jews Against Anti-Muslim Racism, Jews Say No, and the Nakba Project. Asaf Calderon is an Israeli-American organizer and member of Jewish Voice for Peace in New York City. He was born in Tel Aviv in 1991 and moved to New York City in 2016. Asaf has a degree in history of the Middle East and the history of Africa from the University of Tel Aviv, and he currently studies for his Master's of Social Work at Hunter College. Joining me today, in Heidi Boghossian's absence, is Abdin Jabara, a former head of the Arab American Anti-Discrimination Committee and a leader of the National Lawyers Guild. Asaf Calderon, Donna Neville, welcome to Law & Disorder, and Abdin Jabara, you're our guest host today with me. Welcome back to Law & Disorder. It's nice to see all of you.
Thank you. Donna, this report that you issued recently is an extremely important report because it shows that mainline Jewish charities are actually involved in the funding of Islamophobes in this country. But I would like to ask you, if you don't mind, to describe exactly what it is that your findings were and how you arrived at these findings, if you will.
Sure. It's good to be on the show with all of you. And I do want to say that Abdin has been a source of inspiration to many of us who are doing this work to challenge Islamophobia. You know, it's very important to remember the history that came before us and those who've been out there doing it. So thank you, Abdin. So we... And in Chicago also, and in a couple of other cities, we were getting word that some of the Jewish communal funds were in fact funding Islamophobic groups, and really funding some of the most virulent Islamophobic groups. So Mark Singh Putterman, who's an activist and a scholar, brought to us some of the initial information, you know, that made clear that this was happening, and asked if he, you know, he had known that we were interested in this issue, that we'd been doing research on it, and asked if we were interested in exploring it further. So that's why when a few of our groups Jews Say No, Jews Against Anti-Muslim Racism, and Jewish Voice for Peace New York came together to look specifically at New York. Chicago, groups in Chicago from the Network Against Islamophobia and Jewish Voice for Peace out there had already been doing research and identifying the Islamophobic groups that were being funded by their Jewish United Fund and had come out with a report. So we then researched, led by Ellie Balkin, the 990 forms. So it was right there, very clearly stated in their 990 forms, you know, who they fund. And these groups came out, and those were the groups that we identified in our report. And, you know, these are groups that have been known as the Islamophobia Network in the U.S. You know, so that's the history of that. And it grew out of our concern and commitment to making sure that the Jewish communities are not supporting Islamophobia in any way, and certainly funding it is a major way.
I assume, Donna, and correct me if I'm wrong, that the people who contributed to these Jewish communal groups did it with under the United States Internal Revenue Tax Law that gives them a charitable deduction. Is that correct?
I'm assuming that's the case. I mean, however it works, that they're received, you know, their federal form 990 filing, which revealed that going back to at least 2001, they've been funding these anti-Muslim hate groups, with six of them receiving a total of more than, you know, $2 million between 2013 and 2017. That's the last year for which these forms are publicly available. I assume they get whatever one receives when you're giving these tax charitable contributions. So, yes, I guess is the answer to your question, right?
So you and Ellie published a report some years back, both online and in print, which is now available on Amazon, called Israel and Islamophobia. Can you tell me any kind of differences between what you found in that report and the current report that you've now issued?
Sure. What Ellie and I wrote about, and one of the articles in the book that we had originally published in 2012, Following the Money from Islamophobia to Israel Right or Wrong, that expanded on some of the work that groups like CAP, the Center for American Progress, had been doing. So CAP had put out what became a report that got a lot of attention called, put out Fear, Inc., The Roots of the Islamophobia Network in America. And it was very valuable investigative journalism, but it made almost no connection between Islamophobia and Israel. And while there had been people who'd been writing about that, and it had come out in some publications, but it hadn't really been, certainly in liberal and mainstream publications, it was rarely mentioned. And so our article and our work sort of took the next step. So we looked at the seven biggest funders of the Islamophobia Network, and we then explored the links between these funders and groups in Israel and the U.S. with hardline Israel politics. So in our report that we've done now, in the report about the Jewish Communal Fund, that link is mentioned briefly, but our purpose, and clearly we know that these Islamophobic groups are also hardline supporters of Israel, but our purpose in writing this report, this specific report that we've all done together, is to really further expose, building on the work of people like Eli Clifton and others, the financial support the JCF has been providing to these virulently Islamophobic groups, you know, with the purpose of putting community pressure on to stop this funding. So it's an organizing tool. This report is really an organizing tool, and our hope is to just share it as widely as possible, and ultimately our goal, which we won't stop until it happens, is for the JCF to stop funding these groups.
How is it that some supporters of Israel think it benefits Israel to promote the Islamophobia in the United States?
What the anti-Muslim ideologues are doing is, like, they're helping to provide this, like, conceptual framework, right? Islamophobic and Israel, right or wrong, the clash between civilizations, and of course Muslims and Arabs are all conflated as if they're one. So it's creating this context and this framework to be anti-Palestinian, to be anti-Muslim. You know, it's rooted in this ideology, and so there's a real consistency between interrelationship between so many of the Islamophobes and the supporters of Israel, right or wrong.
How do you think this dovetails in with the political and legal attacks on immigrants and refugees that's going on now in the USA?
As we know right now, and we see it, right, it didn't start, as we all know very much so, that did not begin with this current administration, but we see it escalating on steroids. The white supremacy, anti-xenophobia, you know, the Islamophobia, anti-black racism, anti-Semitism. And so we see that homophobia and transphobia, for sure. We're seeing how there's an attack on all these communities. And so it's very connected. And, of course, there are black immigrants. There are black Muslims. There are Muslims who are immigrants. I mean, there's so many multiple identities also within each of our communities. So, yes, I think that our struggles are, and I think it's no accident, no coincidence, and very intentional that so many of our movements for justice are working together, you know, as closely as they are.
Donna, I would like to ask you about what the reaction has been, whether there's been any high-profile Jewish leaders that have come out and denounced this funding of Islamophobia by these federations, and whether or not the organizations such as the ADL that are specifically organized to combat hate, whether they have come out and denounced it. Because, people are called on all the time to denounce anti-Semitism, and they should be. They should be called on that, and they should denounce anti-Semitism and anti-Semites. But why shouldn't we be denouncing people and organizations that are funding Islamophobia?
Well, first of all, I'm sure you're not surprised to hear that the ADL has not come out and condemned this funding, despite the fact that, as you say, they are an organization that says that they're committed to fighting hate. We haven't had mainstream Jewish leaders coming out, although we do have a lot of people in a number of different Jewish communities who have told us that they have really, they read the report. They very much appreciated our solid research. Nobody's argued with the contents in terms of, you know, it not being 100% accurate. And many have told us that they're going to be in touch with the JCF. And we have learned of at least a few people, and there are likely more, who have told JCF who they've sent money through JCF, that they will no longer do so. But we're continuing this. Asaf, do you want to talk a little bit more about our efforts in terms of how we're going to keep this moving?
So first of all, our demands are that the JCF stops all funding to anti-Muslim groups, that they will cease to fund groups like that in the future, and that they will publicly commit to that. And we are planning to put public pressure on them so that they will have to be accountable for that.
You know, we're really making sure that we make this issue as visible as possible, because there's zero justification, obviously, for a penny going to any of these groups. And the JCF has the right, I mean, they have the obligation and the right to end this funding. They can turn down grants. That's part of their right.
I was thinking back to when Pamela Geller, one of the people mentioned in your report, was on a campaign to stop construction of a school called a madrasa, about a half a mile from the site of the World Trade Center. It was just hysterical. And what I wanted to ask you and Asaf is, what is it that these Islamophobes actually do? What did Pamela Geller do? What did David Horowitz do? What does Daniel Pipes do?
The American Freedom Defense Initiative, headed by Pamela Geller, spearheaded the 2010 opposition to the madrasa that was built near Ground Zero, and she claimed that mosques are all Trojan horses. She also put subway ads saying that in the war between civilized men and savages, we must support civilized men, implying that Muslims are savages. So all sorts of attacks of that nature. We have also the Clarion Project over there, which distributed a video that claimed that Muslims in the West are a fifth column in an ancient war of Islam against the West. So this War of Civilizations or Clash of Civilizations theory that is really putting all Muslims under like the same bucket of like so-called radical Islam.
Daniel Pipes, as we know, is one of the most virulent Islamophobes who, as many may recall, showed his face during the Debbie Almentassar case, which, for those who might not know, who are listening, was the case of the first Arabic-English dual-language public school in New York City, one of, at that time, close to 70 public schools that were opening, and that Daniel Pipes, as soon as the Islamophobes found out about it, created a major Islamophobic campaign. And I won't go into the details of that, but needless to say, it was virulent Islamophobes who had the campaign, although an important point to note is that they weren't the ones who closed down the school, who fired Debbie Almentassar, the principal at the time. It was the city of New York, the mayor of New York, and the Department of Education that did. And I mentioned that because the Islamophobes, you know, screamed and yelled, but it's the power of the state to then do what it does. And increasingly, these Islamophobes are having have a lot of relationships with government. But as some might remember, Daniel Pipes alleged that former President Obama, quote, enforced Islamic law. You know, he's really has been the go-to person. He's from the Middle East Forum. And he's really been described, you know, as sort of person who helps lead and foment a lot of the Islamophobic campaigns that are going on. So, you know, he's the fact that there's any funding going to Daniel Pipes or, as you mentioned before, to Pamela Geller. I mean, these are the key Islamophobes in the country.
Donna, there are a lot of people who are listening to this program belong to different organizations or around the country, peace and justice groups. What is your recommendation for individuals to do in terms of exposing this? Do you think we should have a, if you see something, say something campaign with regard to Islamophobia? Because we've got people, for instance, Steven Spielberg has set up this foundation, the Shoah Foundation, and he had a big interview in the New York Times 2 days ago where he mentions their outreach and involving other groups, but he never once mentions Islamophobia or Muslims in it. So what do you recommend that we be doing, all of us?
I mean, I think one of the things, for example, we've been saying about this, about what's happening here, is that if it had been discovered that a foundation, a communal fund, was supporting neo-Nazi anti-Semitic white supremacist groups, we would rightly, I mean, absolutely rightly, all be up in arms. And that should be no different in this case. And there are amazing Muslim and other impacted groups who are organizing against Islamophobia. And for those of us who are part of Jewish groups, we join as partners in this movement to both work together with them, but also to hold our own communities accountable. So I feel like one of the things we need to keep doing is to saying this needs to be an issue in our community. Islamophobia is both, you know, hateful acts that are of violence on the streets, but it's also embedded in the structures of our society, in the, quote, war on terror, and in so many anti-Muslim policies. In terms of how this country, this government, acts both domestically as well as in terms of its foreign policy. And I just think we should be making sure this issue is visible and alive. And those of us who aren't being targeted daily, who aren't in that position, need to still be out there. In fact, we need to be really doing what we can to make sure that Islamophobia is not normalized or considered okay, because it's not. And I don't know, Asaf, if you want to add to, you know, to more to what I've just said.
We are calling on all organizations that are currently receiving funds from the JCF to demand that the JCF will no longer operate with these organizations or that we stop working with them. And we're calling on our community, the Jewish community, to stand up and to resist this these hateful acts that are done on our name, because as part of the Jewish Federation of New York, this organization claims to represent us. I think it's important for all Jews to stand against Islamophobia, and I think that most Jews do stand against Islamophobia. Most Jews in the United States do stand against Islamophobia, and we encourage everybody to rise up against this publicly.
How did you two get involved in this kind of political work? Donna, you go first, and Asif will give you the last word.
Well, I've been concerned about Islamophobia, you know, as long as I had known about it. But I must say that it was working in support of the Khalil Gibran International Academy after Debbie Allman. That was the school I mentioned, the first Arabic-English dual-language public school in New York, where I saw how virulent the attacks were, where I saw how my community, the Jewish community, how many organizations fell by the wayside, where I saw at that point, because the story and what happened involved Israel politics, where I saw in living color how Israel politics and Islamophobia went hand in hand, and where I really saw how the power of the state in fomenting Islamophobia. And so I think from then on, and we had built a coalition, a community together that's continued these years later of working together. And those, the few of us who were Jewish in that coalition, have continued to work together with other Jews challenging Islamophobia as well. So that's my beginnings. And again, I want to say that early on, Abdeen, you were one of the people who, you know, encouraged us to keep going. And then, of course, the work that Ellie Bulkin and I did together and that we continue to do with Jews Against Anti-Muslim Racism has just, and now the work we're all doing with Jewish Voice for Peace New York and other organizations, and Jews Say No.
Asif Calderon, you're an Israeli from Tel Aviv, and you're living here in New York City, going to school here. How did you get involved in this? What was it that urged you along this path?
Islamophobia in Israel is very prevalent, and it's part of the policy of all governments. Basically, my entire life, we've been living, breathing Islamophobia in our school system, in our media, and in our politics. So for me, part of my opposition to the occupation and my opposition to Israeli colonialism was also dismantling this idea of a clash between Jews and Muslims and the very prevalent Israeli narrative that radical Islam is what is preventing peace in the Middle East. When I came here, I wasn't aware of all of these American, you know, Islamophobic groups back in Israel. But then when I came here, I was like, oh, okay, well, that's a very similar sort of form of incitement. In the same way that I was struggling against that in Israel, I joined as part of Jewish Voice for Peace. I've joined the struggle against this particular form of racism here, because I believe that just as in Israel, we need to colonize the country, find a way to live together, that should also be the goal here in the United States.
Asif Calderon, Donna Neville, thank you so much for being on Law and Disorder. Abdeen Jabbar, thank you so much for joining me as my co-host. And how do people get a hold of this report?
You can get the report. You can email me, denevel@gmail.com, and we will be happy to email it to you right away. I think that would be the best way to get it.
Asif, Donna, thanks again, and every success in your work. You take it easy.
Thanks so much, Michael. Thanks for having us on.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
If you have any comments or questions about this segment or any others, please visit us at lawanddisorder.org. That's lawanddisorder.org.
Law and Disorder has been broadcasting for nearly 13 years now. We started on WBAI in New York City and are now carried on nearly 100 affiliate stations across the country. We'd like to take a moment to thank them.
WBAI 99.5 FM, New York City. KRFP 90.3 FM, Radio Free Moscow, Moscow, Idaho. WRFN 107.5 FM, Nashville, Tennessee. KSOW 106.7 FM, Cottage Grove, Oregon. WYAP 101.7 FM, Clay, West Virginia.
KRFC 88.9 FM, Fort Collins, Colorado. WRCT 88.3 FM, Carnegie Mellon University in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. KWMD 90.7 FM, Kasilof, 104.5 FM radio, Anchorage, Alaska. WXOJLP 103.3 FM, Northampton, Massachusetts.
KEIFFM 104.7 FM, Enid, Oklahoma. WPVM 103.9 FM, Asheville, North Carolina. ISPCA Radio, Indiana, online to Chicago. Motion Community House Radio, online.
WLRI 92.9 FM, Gap, Pennsylvania. WPRR 1680 AM, Grand Rapids, Michigan. WCRS 102.1 FM, Columbus Community Radio. 98.3 FM, Central Ohio. KKFI 90.1 FM, Kansas City, Missouri.
Free Radio Santa Cruz, WSLR-FM 96.5, Sarasota, Florida, KDX Internet Radio, KDX World Around Radio, Lorain Community College Radio, WHUS 91.7 FM, Storrs, Connecticut,
WJFF Radio Catskill 90.5 FM, WDRT 91.9 FM, Viroqua, Wisconsin.
That's where I used to go fishing with Michael Ratner.
WERU 89.9 FM, Blue Hill, Maine, 99.9 FM, Bangor, Maine, Redwood Community Radio.
KMUD 91.1 FM, Garberville, California. KMUE 88.3 FM, Eureka, California. KLAI 90.3 FM, Laytonville, California. Voice of Sacramento 88.7 FM, Sacramento Community Radio.
WWPM MediaNet, Nokomis, Illinois. Community Radio for Cape Cod, WOMR 92.1, Provincetown, Mass., where I grew up. WMHC 91.5 FM, Mount Holyoke College, South Hadley, Mass., where I did three semesters.
You dropped out.
KSER FM 90.7 FM, Everett, Washington.
WHUS 91.7 FM, University of Connecticut. Free Radio Olympia, Olympia, Washington. WCRS, LPFM, 98.3 FM and 102.1 FM, Columbus, Ohio. KSKQ 94.9 FM, Homegrown Radio, Ashland, Oregon. WAZU 90.7 FM.
WGCX 90.7 FM, Community Radio, Greene and Columbia Counties, New York. WGCX 90.7 FM, Community Radio, Greene and Columbia Counties, New York. KSVR 91.7 FM, Skagit Valley Community Radio. KYRS 92.3 FM and 89.9 FM, Thin Air Community Radio, Spokane, Washington.
WQVR, The Eye, 1640 AM, Sandersdale, Southbridge, Massachusetts. WFTE, 90.3 FM and 105.7 FM, Scranton and Mount Cobb, Pennsylvania. Rochester Free Radio, WRFI, 91.9 FM, Watkins Glen. WINO 89.9 FM, Odessa, and 88.1 FM, Ithaca, New York. WEFT 90.1 FM, Champaign, Illinois.
Radio Phoenix, online community radio, Phoenix, Arizona. Boston Free Radio, Geneva Community Radio, your voice for many voices in the Finger Lakes. KAOS 89.3 FM, Olympia, Washington. KWTF, Sonoma County, California.
Radio Free Kansas, Northeast Kansas, KABU, 90.7 FM, Community Radio, Portland, 100.7 FM, Corvallis, 91.9 FM, Hood River, WSCA, 106.1 FM, Portsmouth, New Hampshire, WZRD, 88.3 FM, Chicago, Illinois,
KOWA, 106.5 FM, Olympia, Washington, WRIR, 97.3, Richmond, Virginia, KMEC, 105.1 FM, Ukiah, California, KSVU, 90.1 FM, Concrete, Washington, WXPI, 88.5 FM, Williamsport, Pennsylvania,
KNSJ, 89.1 FM, San Diego, California, KGHI, 91.1 FM, Westport, Washington, Our Streaming Planet Podcast, WPFW, 89.3 FM, Washington, D.C., KPFT, 90.1 FM, Houston, Texas, 89.7 FM, Huntsville, Texas, 89.5 FM, Galveston, Texas, WOOL FM, 91.5 FM, Bellow Falls, Vermont, Black Sheep Radio,
KGIG, 104.9 FM, Salida, California, KEUL, 88.9 FM, Girdwood, Alaska, KRDILP, 103.1 FM, Duval, Washington, WUMD, 89.3 FM, University of Massachusetts, Dartmouth, KWRKLP, 90.9 FM, Alaska Peace Center, Fairbanks, Alaska,
WGRNLP, 94.1 FM, Columbus, Ohio, WOOC, 105.3 FM, Troy, New York, WHYR, LP, 96.9 FM, Baton Rouge Community Radio, Baton Rouge, Louisiana, and Workforce Rising Online, KBFG, 107.3, Seattle, Washington, and KKRN, 88.5 FM, Round Mountain, California.
And we'd like to extend a special thanks to KNSG, 89.1 FM in San Diego, as well as KGHI, 99.1 FM in Westport, Washington.
WMNB, LP, 107.1 FM, North Adams, Massachusetts.
KODXLP, 96.9 FM, Seattle, Washington.
KKRN, 88.5 FM, Round Mountain, California.
KBFG, 107.3 FM, Seattle, Washington.
WEJPLP, 107.1 FM, Wheeling, West Virginia.
That's on Mondays at 7 a.m. and Friday at 7 p.m. And finally, the Progressive Radio Network on Wednesdays at 5 p.m. If you're not on this list and would like to be, please contact lawanddisorder.org, our producer Jeff Brady, so we can count you among our growing list of stations, and we'll notify you of upcoming programs and specials. Thank you.